From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're following the news today that Senator Bernie Sanders has ended his presidential campaign the second time he has done that. He said he could not in good conscience continue on. He will work with Vice President Joe Biden to move progressive ideas forward, and he also called on his supporters to continue the fight for justice.
Yes, Robin, and we'll have more on that a little later. Meanwhile, another big story in Washington is President Trump's decision to remove the Defense Department's acting inspector general. Glenn Fine was in charge of tracking how $2 trillion in coronavirus relief money will be spent. He was chosen by other inspector generals until President Trump removed him this week. The president was asked yesterday about his decision.
When we have reports of bias and when we have different things coming in. I don't know Fine. I don't think I ever met Fine. I heard the name.
Let's bring in NPR's Tim Mak. And Tim, can you first address the president's suggestion of bias? What do we know about Glenn Fine? Is there any evidence of bias in his decision making?
There doesn't seem to be any sort of evidence that Glenn Fine was biased. In fact, he's a longtime government watchdog who has served in Republican and Democratic administrations from Clinton through the Bush administration through the Obama administration to the current administration. And he served for more than a decade as the Justice Department's Inspector General at the beginning of this coronavirus crisis. As you mentioned, he was serving as the acting Inspector General at the Pentagon. His reputation was solid enough that he was chosen by fellow Inspectors General to head up this powerful accountability organization. And that's kind of the background and the basis for his reputation.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in a statement yesterday that Fine's removal is, quote, part of a disturbing pattern of retaliation by the president against independent overseers. What are some of the larger concerns being raised here about the president removing Fine?
Well, I think one big concern that Democrats have is that the president is trying to disrupt oversight into this coronavirus response package. The reaction has been quite negative among Democrats, especially those involved in oversight of the Trump administration. I'll give you one example. House Oversight Committee Chair Carolyn Maloney said that Fine's removal was a, quote, direct insult to the American taxpayer of all political stripes who want to make sure their tax dollars are not squandered. So the basic sense is that there's a concern that it's not just Fine, but in general that this administration is not handling oversight well.
Can you put this in context for us, how unusual it is for a president to get involved with who oversees funding? Is that something that we've actually seen in recent administrations?
Well, the president has responded to some of this questions about the removal of Fine by saying that he has the authority to remove Fine. And that's certainly true, but it's also unusual to happen on the scale and also unusual due to the circumstances of this removal. And Glenn Fine isn't the only inspector general who the president has picked to fight with. This is all taking place at a time where the administration is actually trying to go back to Congress and asking for more money. And it may lead to some pushback from Democrats who may not be assured that the money will be spent with sufficient oversight by this administration.
Okay, so President Trump has now chosen Sean O'Donnell, the inspector general at the EPA, to take Fine's place. What do we know about O'Donnell?
Well, prior to becoming the inspector general, O'Donnell spent some 15 years at the Department of Justice, including as a prosecutor in the criminal division. And, O'Donnell is currently the acting replacement for Glenn Fine at the Pentagon. However, the president has nominated Jason Abend, whose experience is in policy at the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, not as a government watchdog. So the president has nominated a permanent replacement for Fine at the Pentagon, who doesn't have experience in this sort of internal oversight role.
And this comes just days after the president fired the inspector general for the intelligence community, Michael Atkinson, who was the one who told Congress about the whistleblower complaint that led to the president's impeachment. So there's a lot of movement here. That's NPR's Tim Mak. Tim, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the coronavirus started the chain of events in our next story. You're probably well aware that the acting Secretary of the Navy, Thomas Modley, resigned yesterday over his handling of a COVID-19 outbreak on the aircraft carrier, the USS Theodore Roosevelt. Modley fired the captain, Brett Crozier, after Crozier wrote an email asking higher-ups for help. His sailors were sick. He wanted to get them off the ship. His superiors worried about readiness if the ship was emptied. Retired Admiral James Stavridis has been watching from the sidelines. So, Admiral, you know, pick up the story and tell us your thoughts.
Well, this is a story in which there are no winners, right? 3 months ago, Captain Brett Crozier was the commanding officer of a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier with 5,000 sailors about to go on a forward deployment. Tom Modley was a very effective undersecretary of the Navy, widely regarded as balanced, sensible, and in command of the Navy at that level. Enter coronavirus. It infects the ship, and the captain feels very strongly he's got to protect the health of his crew. He's right to feel that way. He asked to go into port in Guam. That's where the ship ends up. And then Secretary Modley, I think, makes a mistake at this point, probably overreacting to the email you mentioned, which did get into the public domain. He fires Captain Crozier. And then, Robin, inexplicably, he flies to Guam, gets on the ship's announcing system, and in front of essentially 5,000 sailors, says the captain is either naive or stupid. So this is a very dark set of facts. And what the Navy needs to do is simply get the ship back to health and back on the front lines.
Does it say anything more, though, about the Navy? You've spoken just now highly of Modley. He was the acting Secretary of the Navy. Some might read into that that maybe a civilian who didn't belong there, but you seem to think he was doing well. Does it say anything more about what's happening in the Navy right now, or is this just the effect of this virus and the stressful times that we're in?
It's a bit of both, Robin, and many will recall 2 years ago the Navy had two terrible collisions at sea in which 17 sailors died, two of our destroyers hit merchant ships. Since that moment 2 years ago, the Navy has not been all that it should be, and this incident will further set the Navy back in its public perception. Having said that, I'm very confident the Navy will sail on from this moment, get this situation under control, and deal with this COVID virus, which the whole country is dealing with. All of this is terra incognita for the entire nation. The Navy is a reflection of that at this point. The Navy has to do better, get the ship back to sea. And we are going to be able to do that, I'd say, over the next 2 to 4 weeks.
We'll also track coronavirus in its ranks because these are people who live very close together. It could have spread like wildfire. If you were about to step on that ship as the new captain, what's the first thing you'd do?
Well, the new captain did just step on the ship. And here's an interesting thing. He's the old captain. He's the previous captain. He'll tell the crew three things. Number one, the Navy cares about you and your health. We're going to fix the infectious state of the crew. I think there are now 250 of them infected. Number two, he'll say, our mission, once we get healthy, is to get back to a combat-ready status and get underway. And number three, I know this ship. I was the commanding officer. I am part of the legacy of the Theodore Roosevelt. That's why the Navy picked me to come. We're going to do this together. That'll be, I think, how he takes this on.
Should Captain Crozier be reinstated either on that ship or another?
I think Captain Crozier should not be career terminated. I think at this point it would be untenable for him to go back to the Theodore Roosevelt. What I would do is put him ashore, but in a productive billet and perhaps doing something that helps the Navy do better as we respond to this coronavirus. He's experienced it on the front lines. He's a highly capable officer. Let's hope he can continue to contribute in that way in the Navy.
Well, he's experiencing it personally. He has it. Should the president get involved? We know that President Trump said things like Crozier shouldn't have written the letter, but he was just a guy having a bad day, and I might get involved, the president said. NPR's Tom Bowman told us already there are concerns about that. Why?
Indeed. There are, as you would guess, several investigations that are underway. When the president weighs in on a military justice system, it's called command influence. And what it means is that all of the admirals or generals in the other services in the chain of command, they hear the commander in chief opine on a situation. It then influences how they look at outcomes. So I would hope the president would stay out of this one. I wish the president, by the way, had stayed out of the issues surrounding the SEALs, Chief Eddie Gallagher. That was inappropriate in my view. This would be inappropriate as well. Let the system take its course.
Retired Admiral James Stavridis, also former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. Admiral Stavridis, thank you for your unique perspective.
Thanks, Robin. Great to be with you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
So into the ongoing coronavirus crisis came a jolt today and a reminder there's a presidential election on the horizon. And once again, Bernie Sanders won't be the Democratic candidate. Senator Sanders announced in a live stream from his home in Vermont that he is ending his second campaign for president, clearing the way for former Vice President Joe Biden to become the Democratic Party's nominee to take on President Trump in November. And he lauded his supporters for what they've achieved.
We have taken on Wall Street, the insurance companies, the drug companies, the fossil fuel industry, the military industrial complex, the prison industrial complex, and the greed of the entire corporate elite. That struggle continues. While this campaign is coming to an end, our movement is not.
Washington State Democratic Representative Parmila Jayapal endorsed Sanders. She joins us now. And Congresswoman, your thoughts?
Thank you, Robin. Well, I think that this is a very difficult moment for me and others across the country who have been so incredibly inspired by Senator Sanders and the movement that he's leading, most importantly, the ideas that he has been willing to champion. I think there's this sense that there's only certain things that are politically possible, but that's only if we don't believe that we deserve them or that we can have them. And I think that is what Senator Sanders has done. I don't think that will stop, and I think that we desperately need his leadership right now in the midst of this crisis. I think, you know, one of the ironies of Senator Sanders suspending his campaign right now is he's been the champion for healthcare justice, and he's suspending his campaign at a moment that this pandemic is worsening and healthcare across this country is on the line for so many people. Mm. But it is essential that we leverage everything we have to win the White House back in November and to make sure that the ideas that Vice President Biden will be putting forward as the Democratic nominee are big enough to address the real issues that were existing before but have been heightened by this pandemic.
Well, let's take that up, because he said today, we won the ideological war, you know, and his ideas did shape the primary, as you know, probably, you know, most notably his push for universal single-payer health care. And as we are in a health crisis and inequity is laid bare, we're seeing that, you know, we're reporting on it today. You would think that his ideas would be taken forward by Biden and the party. But on the other hand, the party seemed to get skittish towards the end about, you know, being, you know, as progressive and seemed to pull back at the end. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think we have to make sure that the party does pick up those ideas. I am the lead sponsor of Medicare for All in the House. We've had tremendous push forward. And honestly, the voters, including those who voted for Vice President Biden or other candidates, are clear, and this was before the pandemic hit, were clear that they supported universal health care. What that means, though, is we have to have the courage to take on those entrenched interests. And so that is going to be the work now, not only because it's the right thing to do, by the way, but also because it will be politically necessary. Bernie Sanders, all of us as surrogates, we don't just snap our fingers and get people excited about coming out to vote. We have to be able to prove to them that we have solutions that will match the scale of the devastation that people are feeling across the country. So that is going to be the next piece of this, is even though Senator Sanders is suspending his campaign, we need to make sure that we are working with the Biden camp and with the vice president himself to recognize and push forward and step up to this moment with the kinds of solutions, things like a guaranteed federal paycheck guarantee program, things like universal health care. Those are the things that not only are what's needed for the country, but will allow us and propel us to beat this current pandemic and create a country that works for everyone.
And by the way, Sanders also said today that while Biden will be the nominee, Sanders will stay on the ballot in states that have yet to vote so he can continue to gather delegates and, as he said, exert significant influence over the party platform. But what about the influence over his followers, many of them notoriously loyal to him, the Bernie bros? Will someone like you, first of all, you said you can't just snap your fingers. Will you endorse Biden? And will you tell your followers this is the right thing to do?
We all are going to do what we need to do to win the White House, and that includes endorsing the Democratic nominee. But what I was trying to say, and that is Joe Biden, what I was trying to say, though, is that it will require Joe Biden to step up now as well. He is going to have to welcome and embrace many of the things that I think we're seeing in dramatic form right now. And the details of this do matter, by the way, Robin. We need to make sure that Senator Sanders retains the state delegates that he has won in the 31 states, and that 100% of the delegates that he wins going forward will contribute. So the details do matter. We need to hear those. But I think that this is a moment for us to celebrate the leadership of a tremendous leader, a friend, and somebody I've campaigned fiercely for and with, and also the movement that will continue regardless of whether or not Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, thank you so much for weighing in on Bernie Sanders announcing today he has dropped out of the race. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to turn back to the coronavirus crisis, which our next guest is taking very seriously. He thinks the CDC recommendation that all Americans wear non-medical grade face coverings, maybe a bandana, is the right public policy. It will save lives. He's respectfully not going to do it. Aaron Thomas is an educator working with disadvantaged students who aspire to become doctors at Ohio State University. He's in Columbus, Ohio. And Aaron, we know you're weighing two things in your decision, both having to do with your health. Give us the bumper sticker.
Well, first, I want to clear up. I do plan to wear a mask, Robin. It's just that when I do wear a mask, it has to be clear that it is a mask that I'm wearing.
Right.
And the reason behind this is, as a black man living in America, there's literally no way that I felt comfortable and or safe walking into a convenience store, a grocery store, a pharmacy with a bandana or something else like a scarf covering my face.
Right.
And that's just a fear that comes from, 35 years of life living in America, and that was brought to the forefront of my consciousness during the pandemic. And, black folks and community of colors are hyper aware of the danger that awaits us every time we leave the house.
Right, and you're not the only one saying this, I should say. Many people are pointing this out, that there are examples of presumed criminality, and then up popped a new one. These are the two men who were escorted out of a Walmart in mid-March. They were shopping wearing surgical masks in Wood River, Illinois, followed by a police officer who took them out. One of them recorded on a cell phone. Let's listen.
He just followed us from outside, told us that we cannot wear masks. There's a presidential order. There is a state order. And he's following us right now to the store. We're being asked to leave for being safe.
Now, the police officer said incorrectly that there was a city ordinance prohibiting face masks. The Wood River police are investigating. But that seems to be, Aaron, exactly what you're talking about, only they didn't even have a bandana on, which you worry about. They did have a surgical mask.
Right. And that's, you know, that's incredibly telling. And, you know, for the thousands and thousands of people who have, you know, expressed to me either publicly or privately that this fear is coming true, it really, really gives power to everything that we're saying, everything that people are talking about. And it really highlights the commonality of the, you know, the Black or Brown American experience for many people here in this country. And I do want to point out, you know, for every one time that an incident is recorded, there's probably 30 other that aren't recorded, that we never see, that we never hear from, because people are too scared to speak up about their mistreatment in public.
The U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, who is Black, told CNN he understands these concerns very well, and they're going to try to make sure that no one is unduly harmed by COVID-19 or our response to it, meaning a request for masks. And I do want to be clear. You said, I'm not going to wear a bandana. I'm not going to do this, you know, tying a scarf around. It looks too much, you know, as you said, I think the quote was, for me, the fear of being mistaken as an armed robber is greater than the fear of contracting COVID-19. They both negatively affect your health.
Right. Yeah. Right. But the, you know, there's the clear and present danger, the immediate one that I can see and that I can feel. And that definitely makes the difference.
Yeah. Which is, as you say, a bias that you're right now concerned about. You also said in the couple seconds we have, you'll just get in and out of that store fast. You're going to try to be as healthy as you can and not infect other people.
Yes, like supermarket sweep. I will absolutely do that. Yes. Yes.
That's Aaron Thomas, an educator for disadvantaged students in Columbus, Ohio, at Ohio State University. By the way, they all want to become doctors, so I think there's a lesson for them as well. And if you've said if you get a medical mask, you will wear that.
Correct, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Your opinion piece appeared in the Guardian and the Boston Globe. Aaron Thomas, thank you so much, and stay well.
Thank you. You do the same, Robin.
And here's an eye-opening statistic. 18,000, that's more than half of the world's airplanes, are now grounded. It's an unprecedented number that shows just how global this pandemic really is. But even as airlines cut back flights, pilots and flight attendants still have to report to work, and many of them are now sick and scared. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. And Seth, if you look at the numbers, the continent of Africa has the most grounded at 74%. Europe is next with 72%. And then here in North America, 39% of flights have been grounded. Why are we still flying more than the rest of the world?
First of all, the U.S. airlines did go into this crisis in better shape than a lot of the other airlines around the world. They've also been ordered, as a condition of all that aid they received, the $25 billion that they're getting, to continue serving all their destinations. They're allowed to cut a lot of flights, but they're not allowed to completely cut destinations. So partly it's because they've been told to do this.
Maybe is this why we're hearing that airlines are now canceling flights at the very last minute, which is really frustrating for travelers. Is this kind of the reason that we're seeing this happening?
Yeah, and I should say those figures about the number of airplanes grounded from the data supplier, CH Aviation. The airlines, yeah, are now doing something which used to be kind of a myth that people had. People would say, oh, you know, airlines, if there aren't a lot of people booked on a flight, they'll just cancel the flight. In the past, when I say the past, Tanya, I'm talking about a month ago. Right? Nowadays, the whole world has changed. Wasn't really true, because if you had one empty flight, well, then that airplane had to do something else, operate a full flight. The pilots had to get somewhere else. So they didn't really do it. But now JetBlue, for one, has acknowledged that, yeah, it's canceling flights on what it calls a rolling basis, kind of with short notice. And they're clearly not the only one doing that when they see that there's just not demand.
Yeah, we're hearing how airline workers are really paying the price. Two flight attendants for American Airlines have now died from COVID-19, and hundreds have tested positive across the country. Seth, should airlines be cutting even more flights out of concern for their employees' health and really their passengers' health?
They say that they are just meeting the demand that's out there. They say that they're encouraging only essential travelers to travel, that there are doctors and nurses and others trying to get to help people. Now, these airlines have at least recently sort of changed their view on employees wearing masks, for example. I was talking to employees several weeks ago who said that the airline, these were employees from American Airlines, but clearly others did it too, had sort of said, well, the mask doesn't look good with the uniform, is what they'd been told, that they would scare people. Now the airlines are saying, at least take whatever measures you can, although there are employees still complaining that they're not being given all of the proper equipment that they should be getting, which, I mean, look, there are employees in hospitals saying the same things.
Yeah. I mean, American Airlines, we're here, is not offering paid sick leave. There are lots of issues that are coming up now as the airlines industry tries to overcorrect and really handle what is a crisis for all industries. That's Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
Reports of domestic violence have gone up around the world in the weeks since millions of us are staying indoors. China and Spain saw a surge in calls reporting domestic violence. And in France, the police reported a 30% increase in domestic abuse cases. Similar numbers here in the U.S. Houston police has seen an increase in calls. And in New York City, which has been under lockdown since late March, the city's online domestic violence resource website has seen nearly double the amount of traffic. All of this has prompted the United Nations Secretary General to urge all governments to put women's safety first during this pandemic. Joining us now for more on this issue is Nathaniel Fields. He's the president and CEO of the Urban Resource Institute, a New York-based organization for victims of domestic abuse. As I mentioned, a lot of people are now at home. Many of them are with loved ones. A lot of others are in complicated situations or abusive situations. It's really a tough position to be in.
It's one of the worst times for anyone in the United States, and it's a tough time for a victim of domestic violence. The idea that they're hearing messages of stay home and they know that home is not safe to them, it's just puts them in an impossible situation. And so it's so important for victims of domestic violence to know that our services are open. They can get orders of protection, they can talk to hotline advocates, and they can access shelter beds, safe beds in a confidential location.
And how are you all handling that? You know, because I could guess that someone is at home and they may be thinking, well, I know there are shelters out there, but maybe they're not even open for me to be able to take that risk. Or if I get there, the coronavirus, how are you all mitigating the coronavirus in those environments?
So we've partnered very closely with the Department of Health and other state regulatory entities to create as much safety as possible. At URI, luckily, our shelter affords survivors of domestic violence their own apartments, their own units, so they're not interacting with the rest of the residents and have those kind of protections. But again, the virus is all over New York City, and so we're, again, partnering with the Department of Health. We're working with survivors around ensuring that they know symptoms consistent with the coronavirus, as well as if they are sick, opportunities for them to seek medical attention. So we're very engaged around safety around this pandemic and working with survivors who may be impacted by the coronavirus.
Domestic abuse can take many forms. We're talking physical, psychological. What is your organization seeing in the way of folks who are calling, asking for help right now during this time?
We're seeing a lot more questions around, first of all, are you open? If I needed to use your services, or do you have space and capacity? And we want all individuals to know that we're open to have space and capacity. But then let me back it up a little, because during this time, in its basic form, we know that domestic violence, intimate partner violence, is really about a family member or an intimate partner using a variety of tactics to maintain control and power over you. And that will look like what people know sometimes as physical violence, where I'm going to hit, punch, slap, stab, strangle you in order to control you. And when you start to think about physical violence, there are other types of violence in order to control, but it thrives. Domestic violence and intimate partner thrives when there's isolation. And so when you think about a pandemic that we're facing as a nation and as a city, where individuals are being asked to stay home, stay in your home and don't go outside, this is like a pressure cooker for perpetrators. So imagine, if you will, they were already faced with those challenges to be in a place where you're being asked to stay home, and the person, your home is not safe, and the person who's more than likely going to do harm to you is right there. So it's even more difficult to create a safety plan to for yourself and often your children to leave an abusive relationship. You're right there in the home with very little opportunities to be alone. So that person has even more opportunity to exert their power and control over you.
You know, we're reading in New York that domestic abuse crime was down in March compared to last year. That's according to NYPD statistics. This is despite the fact that we're seeing a spike in people trying to access domestic abuse resources. What do you think is behind that?
You know, survivors are always battling or weighing risk factors, and sometimes a lot of survivors may not go seeking, they may not seek help because the risk of going outside and possibly contracting a virus outweighs the risk of leaving at that particular point. Doesn't mean that domestic violence has gone down or some of the hotline calls in terms of numbers have reduced. It just means at this particular time, that risk factor in terms of the pandemic is so high that it's outweighing their desire to go get help at this particular time. So, you know, it's not the sense that we see a decline. It's just that this particular situation in terms of risk of pandemic and virus is higher.
What are some recommendations, some ways that folks, if they're listening to this right now and they're in a situation like this?
So it's there are things that you still can do. It's going to be more difficult because you know that person better than I could ever. And because you know them, these safety tips that I'm going to provide, you know you're going to have to use them in a way that's best for you and your situation. But it is going to be coming up with that code word that you can use with a friend or neighbor to let them know when you're in danger. It is going to be an opportunity to hopefully have a friend or neighbor or a family member check in with you. And if you have an opportunity to do that, to be able to use those code words. It's going to be a need to have an ability to think about if you had to leave, where could you go and know where the resources are. If you have a moment to be able to take important numbers like our hotline number for the national hotline or the New York City hotline, 1-800-621-HOPE. Those types of tips are very important. Keep money available if you have to rent out the house, that you have access to transportation. So there are things that survivors can do even when options seem so few.
Yeah. You know, I'm also thinking about, it's almost like a pressure cooker when you're in a home with an abuser. And maybe it's not to the level where you need to leave the home, but you might need counseling or legal services. Are those services still available? And what's your recommendation for folks to provide de-escalation or to de-escalate in their homes and then also take that next step for counseling or legal services?
Yeah, those services are still available. A lot of the national hotlines or local hotlines have created features where you don't necessarily have to call in, but you can also text them to be able to receive help. And again, it's very difficult. Listen, before the pandemic, the leading cause of murder, particularly for women, was a result of intimate partner violence. So and that's been consistent for many years. So this is often life and death issues escalated by the sense that it's harder to leave. So the idea that many cities and states and have hotlines available that individuals can use, we want them to know about that because it seems like so many things are shut down that we want individuals to know that these hotline and text messaging and instant messaging services through hotlines are available. And them,
and we're going to give that number.
Yeah, that 1-800-621-HOPE number is the New York City hotline. And of course, the national domestic violence hotline is available nationally.
Yep, and we will be giving that number at the end of our talk. I want to ask you one other question, though. What if you're concerned about someone else in another home that's a loved one or friends that you know are in a precarious situation? How can you help them?
Become knowledgeable. If you know someone, a friend, a loved one that's in an abusive relationship, you suspect that they're in an abusive relationship, go on some of the websites. You can go to URINYC and look at some of our tips. You can go to the National Domestic Violence Hotline and have an understanding of what services are available. So if they come to you, if they use that code word and you respond, you can provide them with information. If they just want to talk to you, create an environment where you can listen without judging them. It ultimately, it's their decision whether they're going to leave or not. But you can be a good friend or family member by listening to them without judgment. And of course, then provide information that you've gathered by doing your own research.
That's Nathaniel Fields, president and CEO of the Urban Resource Institute, a New York-based organization for victims of domestic abuse. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you so much for doing this.
If you or someone you know is in a domestic abuse situation, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. They provide service 24 hours a day and have agents who speak more than 200 languages. And we'll have this information on our website.
There are a lot of things we can't imagine doing right now. Hugs, taking that torn bagel off the pile at work. How about hitchhiking? Before COVID-19 rocked our world, a book on the history of hitchhiking caught our eye. The author was 35-year-old Jack Reed, an historian of American culture. My first thought was, 35, what could he know about hitchhiking? But then he knew a lot. For instance, during the Great Depression and World War II, hitchhiking was widely accepted. People dressed up to do it. But then hitchhiking faded. So what might fade after COVID-19? The book is called Roadside Americans, and author Jack Reed joins us now. Jack, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin. It's a pleasure.
Well, and you know, I'm sure you're thinking, oh, great, I'm publishing a book about hitchhiking at a time when there's no one in the universe who's going to, well, probably pick up a stranger.
Yeah, it's not quite up to the snuff of social distancing rules these days.
Yeah, but it is really informative and eye-opening to look back. If you could just give us the thumbnail, you know, when was hitchhiking popular, respected? When did it start to wane and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So hitchhiking was really common in the 1930s and 40s. And then there's a bit of a dip in the 1950s and a big resurgence in the 60s and 70s. And in the 30s and 40s, hitchhiking was really associated with necessity. And so in the Depression, there were people out of work and trying to find opportunity, and not everyone owned an automobile at that time. So people would take to the road in search of opportunity and work. And people just saw, like, okay, this person's trying to get over there, and I understand that. I'll give them a ride.
Right.
And then in World War II, there was these gasoline and tire restrictions. And so people recognized that things have changed. You know, we can't just drive everywhere we want. And at the same time, you had American servicemen who were trying to get back and forth from their base to their homes to see family and friends. And so there was all these different circumstances that were leading people to hitchhike and to understand why hitchhiking was acceptable. Once the country moved out of that kind of sense of crisis in the 1950s, hitchhiking's popularity and acceptance waned a little bit. But then you had this whole generation of young people who were kind of felt confined by a sense of suburban comfort and wanted to explore that and get a more authentic sense of what the world was about. And so you have young people hitchhiking for adventure, people reading on the road and wanting to get out and explore the world and meet a whole cross-section of people they wouldn't otherwise do so.
Jack Kerouac's on the road. And they went on the road with guitar cases and hippie beads and with their thumb out.
Yeah, absolutely. But by the 80s, you know, you had this sense of change. The economy had shifted. People were more interested in individualism and not really the sense of, like, the whole hippie ethos of cooperation, we can do this together, really lost favor. And you have people far more interested in kind of looking out for themselves. And, you know, hitchhiking just kind of went by the wayside.
It was also a more violent time when you had certain drug epidemics. And it did just sort of become inconceivable. So do you think it's interesting now that, you know, we're once again getting in cars with complete strangers, but it's Uber and Lyft and we're paying for it?
Yeah, it's a commodified version of it. But I don't think people really associate it with hitchhiking, which is interesting because, yeah, these people don't have chauffeur's license. They're not taxi drivers. They're just someone in their car coming to pick you up. And I guess we have the filter of technology, which is showing us like this mass system of, well, other people have ridden with them and given them high marks, so I guess I'm okay. But yeah, it's still at the root, you know, a stranger coming to pick you up.
And as you, again, you have this book on hitchhiking, which would be inconceivable to a lot of people. You know, the idea, wait, you went on a road and you just stuck your thumb out. So with your knowledge of history behind us, can you see something else that might shift because of this moment in time?
It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because something that's as deeply seated as like handshaking in our culture, if we don't do that for 6 months, what's that going to look like moving forward, you know? Mm-hmm. Will people still feel comfortable handshake, or will we go more towards a wave? What will that look like? I also like thinking, the optimist in me, like, what could positively grow out of this? And looking back to my book, I talk about the Great Depression and World War II and how these collective sense of crises that emerged during this time period led to people kind of circling the wagons and kind of fighting for a common cause. And so I am hopeful that there could be a sense of this kind of civic cooperation that may make a return in some of the ways that we saw Americans rally around a common cause in previous crises in the 20th century.
It's so interesting you remind us of how, and I'm looking at an ad in your book, it was a government poster urging Americans to carpool during World War II, you know, get more people in a car. It could be a hitchhiker or a carpooler, because yep. As it says on the poster, when you ride alone, you ride with Hitler, because, yep. You know, you're helping Hitler by using more gas.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of like social programming in some ways, because, you know, Americans had felt entitled, like, I can drive my own car, I'm fine. But I think those kinds of posters, we're just trying to urge people and put things in perspective of what's at stake here. Yes, you are used to driving alone, but now you're going to have to do something different. And that played out in all different kinds of ways. And there's a great deal of volunteerism during World War II, you know, people planting gardens. And I think you'll see some of that come out in this time period, because we are definitely in uncharted territories in some ways with this pandemic.
Well, Jack Riley, you know what else your book does in looking at the history of hitchhiking? It reminds us we have been in horrendous crisis before, you know, whether it was the Great Depression or World War II, inconceivable moments, and gotten through them. His book is Roadside Americans, The Rise and Fall of Hitchhiking and a Changing Nation. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
I just want to ask listeners, what do you think will change after COVID-19? Let us know, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.